You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
A former lawyer is arrested for releasing more than 100 live lobsters into the Minneapolis mayor's indoor swimming pool. After persuading 12 grocery stores to donate the lobsters, he makes his getaway in a rented stretch limousine. Nicholas Ward is brilliant, charming, and passionate about saving animals, but he's also a little delusional. Lena Grant, his ex-wife and ex-law partner, is committed to saving him, but Nick, whose best friend is a puppet, is pushing society's boundaries, and he's either going to be sentenced to prison or to a psychiatric facility. The Island of Always is a cheerful, tongue-in-cheek romp filled with snappy dialogue, vivid characters, and a protagonist whose delusions might actually make the world a better place. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host of New Books in Literature for the New Books Network, and today I'm talking to Stephen Evans, author of The Island of Always.
Hi, Stephen. Thanks for joining me today for this New Books Network podcast.
Hi, Galit. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with a traditional new book opening question. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your education, and how you came to write this charming novel.
I was an English major and philosophy major in college, and then promptly forgot about most of that and spent a lot of time, about 15 years, really mostly doing a lot of theater, a lot of performing. And at one point I was doing Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Were Dead, and I got an idea for a play and I started to write it, and that kind of took off from there, and I've been writing ever since.
I understand that you wrote The Island of Always as an extension of a previous novella from 10 years ago. Can you talk about how you decided to combine the new story with the old one, how you decided to go back to these lovely characters?
Thank you. I wrote The Marriage of True Minds. It was published about 10 years ago, exactly, almost exactly 10 years ago, and by Unbridled Books. And I really enjoyed the characters, and I really missed spending time with them, really. I just enjoyed them. We had talked in the interim about the possibility of maybe doing a movie or a TV show, but that never seemed to work out, and I just wanted the characters to have some more life, and I'd always had some ideas of where the story might go from the end of The Marriage of True Minds. So I finally decided to sit down and actually write it. And as I was doing that, I found I was having to put in so much backstory into the new book that I decided that I really wanted to put the stories together. They're both as individual novels are both fairly short. So I was granted the right to do that by the original publisher very generously. And so I began to put the stories together. And it made for a much smoother storytelling and a much, I think, better experience for the reader, in my opinion. And the two stories really do fit together and really are one long, continuous story, in my view.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of funny moments in the book, and the dialogue is sometimes hysterical. So is this your first stab at writing comedy?
No, I always have written comedy in terms of writing plays. And anytime I write dialogue, it just seems to come out that way. It's just, I hear dialogue that way. I hear the comic possibilities in the dialogue and can't seem to stop myself from following them most of the time. And when you have characters like these who are bright and have a rhythm between them, have a knowledge of who they are and have an understanding of who the other person is, there's a rhythm that develops that you can use as a writer to make funny dialogue realistic throughout the book, which is what I hope I've done.
Mm-hmm. Let's dive into the characters now. Lena.
Yeah.
She's just wonderful. What can you tell us about her?
She's kind of an ideal woman for me. She's smart, she's successful, and even though she knows herself and she knows what she wants out of life, she is so incredibly warm and emotionally generous to the man that she still loves, even though he is very difficult to be around sometimes, that she can't stop herself from continuing to follow him and try and rescue him when his eccentric behavior goes overboard and he gets in a little bit of trouble. So I think
he's a riveting character, that Nick. he really so much fun. Is he based on anyone that you know?
No, he's none of the characters in the book are based on anyone. I've never done that for some reason. I don't write from life. He's really the idea I had for Nick came from Don Quixote. I needed a character who could do the kinds of things that I always wanted to do, but never really had the courage to do, like rescue all of the lobsters in a grocery store or something like that. Someone who was not afraid to go beyond the bounds and who could be successful doing it. So that's where Nick came from, just the need within the story to be able to perform those kind of actions and to do it successfully and with humor.
There's a lot of stories within stories. Nick, for example, tells a Paul Bunyan story. Where did that come from? Did you make that up?
I did make that up, yes. The location where the story is Minnesota. It's set in Minnesota, set in Minneapolis, and in a place in Minneapolis, which was very close to where I lived when I lived there, which was Lake of the Isles, and has these two tiny little lakes sitting in this lake, which is not itself very big. And Paul Bunyan, of course, is a large personality in folk tales of that region. He was probably the major folk character to come out of the logging in Minnesota. And so I put the two together and came up with a creation story for how the lakes of Minnesota came to be and how specifically these two islands in Lake of the Isles came to exist. But it was all made up.
Ah, because Minneapolis is really kind of a character in the story. It's a very important character, the geography. For example, the story of Hennepin Island in the center of the city, where Lena has a building, where Lena lives. Is that also invented?
Yes. The island is there, Hennepin Island is there, but there's nothing on it. It's just an island in the city. There's an island a little farther up called Nicolet Island that does have sort of a structure on it called the Nicolet Island Inn. So I've kind of transposed the two and put them together and created the structure. I think there's just a power station on Hennepin Island. I don't think anyone can live there. So that was a little reimagining of the history of Minneapolis.
Okay. Because I was in Minneapolis last summer, and I remembered Hennepin Island, and I didn't remember anything on it. So I'm glad that it wasn't my memory.
No, that was me.
Early on, after the lobster incident, Nick is sentenced to community service. And I wasn't clear about that. Did he choose the Hennepin Animal Shelter, or was he sent there? In any case, he meets Alice and Ralph. Can you discuss that a little bit?
Yes, he's sent there. It was just an option that was offered to him. But with his love of animals, Lena knew that it was something that would be very acceptable to him. So he goes there and he meets Alice, and Ralph, who are the caretakers of the facility. And they have completely opposite physical personalities, but they are just this wonderful couple who are so devoted to caring for the animals. And Nick becomes very attached to them, and they become very attached to him also. And at the shelter, he learns, and this was one of the reasons that I started to write the book, he learns about the issue of euthanasia in animal shelters across the country. And that was one of my motivations for writing the book. When I was taking care of one of my aunts, actually, she had a magazine called Best Friends, which is a rescue organization out in Utah. And there was an article in there about the millions of pets every year who are euthanized because they're homeless, euthanized in animal shelters. And I was shocked when I read it, and I decided I wanted to write something about it. So that's why Nick takes this kind of a venture into the world of animal shelters. And he meets these really wonderful characters.
Is that happening right now?
Yes, it has improved quite a bit from the time that I started writing, but there's still millions of animals euthanized in shelters across the country every year. It's still a very, very serious issue. A lot of places have passed laws that against these so-called puppy factories that you have to get rescue an animal as opposed to being able to buy from these factories who just turn out dogs without really caring for them. So yeah, it's still a very serious problem, but there's a lot more attention to it these days than there was at the time that I started writing.
And your book pinpoints it as well. Anybody reading this will kind of wonder and in shock that it still exists.
Yeah, yeah.
So the next character is Nick's puppet. He's in every scene in which Nick appears. Can you talk about Sancho?
Yeah, Sancho the puppet. Well, if you're going to have a Don Quixote character, you need a Sancho character, someone who is his companion, who sort of keeps him on the up and up. And I chose, because of Nick's semi-delusional state, I chose a puppet. And the puppet is worked into the story in other ways, into the story between Nick and Lena and what happened to their marriage that made it collapse initially. But Sancho, initially I had written it as a screenplay, and I thought the puppet would work very well visually on the screen. And when I converted it to a novel, I wasn't as certain that it was going to work, because you don't have the same visual aspect, but I found I just liked it too much. It was just too much fun not to have him. And his relationship with Nick, even though it's nonverbal, I think it's very expressive. So they're a good pair.
I thought it was hysterical that whenever somebody accused him of having a puppet, he said something like, he prefers to be known as an unreal American.
Yes.
That's
yes.
Pretty funny.
Thank you. I think that goes to the nature of imagination. Nick just sees the world in a different way, and he sees imagination as not something that is quite as fanciful, but really a way of viewing the world and seeing a truer version of the world. That's the way he sees it anyways.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And he manages to charm everyone in spite of his delusional psychosis. So let's go through the characters still. We have to talk about, for example, let's start with Dr. Richardson.
Yes, yes. Dr. Richardson is, when Nick is sent to the Psychological Institute, which I also made up, by the way, it's not a real place. He meets a doctor there who is really a very unusual character in his own right. He loves to get up on his couch and conduct music, and he and Nick, again, just developed this wonderful rhythm. I think he has seen so much in his practice that he has really developed a tolerance for other ways of looking at the world that maybe makes him a little bit able to understand and communicate with Nick on a different level.
Mm-hmm. How about Oscar?
Oscar is the attendant at the Psychiatric Institute, and he is one of my favorite characters in the book, maybe my favorite character. He's just this wonderful, warm human being, and he loves comic books, and he's always got a beat-up comic book in his pocket, or he's reading. He wears cartoon character ties and funny looking sneakers, and he's just completely himself and completely comfortable being himself. And again, he and Nick form a bond, which is one of the things that Nick is able to do with people. He's just able to appreciate them for who they are, and so they come to appreciate him, I think, for who he is. So they become very, very much partners almost, or a sidekick to Nick as he goes through the rest of his adventures.
So those are the main people in Nick's life. And now in Lena's life, we've got Sharon.
Yes. Sharon is, she came to Lena. She's Lena's assistant. She came to her in a difficult time in Lena's life after she and Nick had split for the first time. And she just kind of took over and became really to Lena what Oscar becomes to Nick, or maybe even to a certain extent, what Sancho becomes to Nick, the person to lean on, the person to talk to, the person to who will tell you the truth about yourself, you know, the kind of person you just absolutely need in your life at those times in your life. And they also form a very strong bond.
I was pulling for Preston Winter. I was on his side. What can you say?
Preston, I initially conceived as being, you know, kind of the bad guy. You need, you know, in these kinds of adventure stories, you always kind of need a bad guy, an oppositional person. But as we went along and as I was writing him, I came to kind of feel sorry for him because his feelings for Lena and his desire to protect her from what he thinks are the depredations that Nick is causing, the pain that Nick is causing her, are very sincere. And so as I was writing, he became more of a good guy who is just so put off by the fact that he can't get past the feelings that Nick and Lena have, that partnership that can't be sundered in any way.
Lena, who is just a really strong character, I love how she enjoys having an adversary. She doesn't want it to be her ex-husband. So she has the Luria Corporation and Harrison Cross as her adversary, and she just has a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, she likes to kind of take it out on other people in her work. And I think that's why her work is important to her, because it gives her a little bit of respite from the constant need to go out and rescue, and the emotional and the physical rescue of Nick. So she kind of gets to take it out a little bit in her work, in the adversarial nature of her work as an attorney. So yeah, the Luria Corporation makes a very good foil for her. I think they're kind of not very nice. So she doesn't feel too bad about trying to do what she does to them.
Wasn't that an intellectual property case, what she's fighting?
It was. Yes. Yes, it was an intellectual property case for over a video game that they had appropriated and stolen. So it just made an interesting way of bringing in the nature of the game itself is sort of a model for what's going on in Lena's life at the time.
So there are a lot of quotations, allusions to poetry and music, and these are really bright, well-rounded people. So therefore, it was a little shocking that the musical piece that he likes to march to every day is John Philip Sousa's Liberty Bell March.
Yeah.
Where'd you come up with
that? The Liberty Bell March. Well, actually, the Liberty Bell March is the opening music to Monty Python's Flying Circus. So I kind of stole it from them and used it from them because they're kind of battiness and craziness. But I think the march itself, the nature of the march, and I really like, personally, I like John Philip Sousa and his marches myself. And I think the martial nature of it indicates Nick's attitude in trying to go out and do good things in the world, to take an aggressive stance and try and make things better in the world. So that's kind of how I came up with that one in particular. It's certainly unusual, but it's good march too. So.
Okay, so Nick's blue suits. That's another character. He buys the same one, five of them, every year.
Yes. That's really an epithet that I took from Einstein. It reflects the nature of genius that you don't want to have unnecessary things get in the way of your imaginary explorations. Einstein supposedly wore the same trousers and sweatshirt every day of his life, at least while he was in America, in Princeton. So I kind of adopted that same thing for Nick. So it's his uniform. It's his, if he's a knight, if he is a knight errant in the way that I saw him in the quixotic way, then this is his armor. He is a modern knight, an attorney, and this is his armor. This is his protection, and it enhances his ability to go out and do the things that he wants to do. So I think that's how he looks at it.
I was waiting for him to burst out into "Hail, Knight of the Woeful Council."
Yeah, that's one of my favorite musicals. I know that. So maybe in a future book.
And then there's a moment that every woman reading this book will be like, "What?" He presents her at her graduation, law school graduation, with a burgundy suit that somehow ties into his, beautifully made, with, yep, as you say, an impossibly perfect fit. Yeah, yes, that's a dream we all have.
Yeah, he's arming her at that point to be his partner. So if he has a suit of armor, then she needs a complimentary suit of armor. So I think that's how he sees it. But he knows these wonderful tailors, and he goes to Italy every year to get these perfectly made suits created just for him. And I'm sure at some point he asks for one for her.
Wow. Yeah, that stayed with me, because I want. All right. So,
oh, okay.
on a serious note, you write about mental illness in a way that's open-hearted and expansive, but still shows the difficulties. Why did you portray mental illness in this way? What led you?
Again, mental illness really came into the book, not really out of my intention to write about mental illness, but out of a need to have a character who was able to go, as I said, beyond the bounds of normal behavior, and knowing how that behavior would be viewed within the context of a regular society. So it wasn't necessarily my intention to write about mental illness, but in creating the character that I created, those issues certainly came up. And especially in the second part of the book, I became very aware of the difficulty of taking care of someone who has these issues, who has these problems, or even if you just think that they have these issues and have these problems, and the stress and the difficulty that would cause. And that came out of some of my own caregiving experiences with taking care of my parents at the end of their life. And I just became a lot more aware of it as I went along in the book, and it became a bigger part of Lena's character. And I think the consciousness of other people being more concerned about her because of what she has had to deal with, and because she doesn't really allow herself any respite, or she will not pull back from what she's trying to do to help and love and take care of Nick.
Mm-hmm. Is your writing process different depending on the kind of work you're writing?
Not really. The form of the story, the nature of the story, always generates the eventual format or genre or whatever I'm doing. So I get the idea for the story first, and then it kind of works itself out into being a play or being a screenplay or being a story or a novel as I go along. And a lot of times the stories will change back and forth. They'll change shape. Like the screenplay will be a novel, which will become a screenplay, which will become a novel again. That happened certainly to the Marriage of True Minds several times. It went back and forth. So it's really the nature of what you're trying to say and what the best way to present the story is that derives that eventually the decision as to what kind of a story you're going to present. So for me, that's how it works.
So, Stephen, I so appreciate you joining me here today, and I'd like to end with a traditional New Books question. What are you working on now, and what's next for Stephen Evans?
Next, I'm actually going back. I'm very excited. I'm going back and writing for the theater again, which I haven't done in a while. I am working on a one-act play. I have a couple of friends who are also writing one-act plays, so we're hoping it will be the three plays together will be produced this summer. And it's a very exciting thing because I've worked with these guys for years and years.
Where will that happen?
I'm hoping it will be in Annapolis, which is kind of where my theatrical life has been centered, Annapolis, Maryland. But we're not entirely certain yet.
Who knows? Today, Annapolis, tomorrow, the world.
You never know. You absolutely never do.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much, and best of luck in all your writing.
Thank you so much. It's been great to be here. I've enjoyed it.
And thank you for listening to this podcast from the New Books Network. Once again, I'm G.P. Gottlieb, host of New Books in Literature, and today I've been talking with Stephen Evans about his new novel, The Island of Always. Join the network to learn about new books of all kinds and to hear my previously recorded podcasts. Goodbye until my next conversation for the New Books Network.